This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, if you buy into American exceptionalism, you might believe the good people of this country are different than everybody else, that this nation's laws and government are uniquely good, and that we have unprecedented respect for human rights. Torture doesn't fit that self-image, and yet my guest Fitzhugh Brundage points out that Americans have justified using torture since our country's earliest days. Fitzhugh Brundage is the William Umstead Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition, and he joins us now. Fitz, welcome back.
It's always a privilege to be here.
Start with this question about how we think about ourselves and our use of torture. Americans, for the most part, if you ask them, would think we're above that, I guess.
Well, ever since the adoption of the Constitution, we've been able to point to our Constitution and say we don't do things that many other countries do. At least, we're not supposed to do them. But expediency, circumstances, and often ideology have sometimes generated enough anxiety, I use the word anxiety to compel Americans to then question whether or not that commitment to not committing torture is ultimately as strong as they think it should have been or that they say it was.
And to give us a sense of how far back this goes in terms of our abhorrence of torture, the fact that we don't believe we're the kind of people who do this, you open your book in the introduction with a piece from Harper's Magazine in 1858 that suggests that they would have expected outrage. Talk about that story.
Absolutely. It was a story published in Harper's Weekly, which was, I don't think we have any magazine like that anymore, but it would be like the Time magazine of its day, of the 1960s or 70s. It's what most people got if they got a magazine. And it was a story about an African-American prisoner in a New York penitentiary who died as a result of what was called a water shower, which was a device to compel proper behavior. And it involved draining water over his head. Very, very cold water, and in such quantities that it often drove people into shock. And in his case, he died as a result. And it was commonly used in not only New York prisons, but many prisons across the United States. And Harper's Weekly wrote this article denouncing the use of such methods and saying that it was contrary to everything America stood for. And it smacked more of the Spanish Inquisition and European tyranny than it did of modern democracy. And that's sort of the argument you're making here, that we associate torture with backwardness, with primitive societies, or with tyrannical societies, not an open democratic society.
And give us a sense, because again, this was what the American experiment was all about. As you've said, we've said it a couple times now, we're not that anymore. This is a new era and a new world, and we're leading the way. So talk about torture through the ages. I mean, how it was used and how it was widely accepted, of course.
Well, the American tradition of torture, if you want to say, obviously grew out of the Western European tradition. With some caveats there, the Western European tradition was one that recognized that there were certain circumstances in which you might need evidence and it wasn't clear how you were going to get it any other way. And I think we should recognize that in, say, the Middle Ages, where there was no forensic technology whatsoever, it's not like there was CSI that was going to find clues. If you had a crime, an alleged offense, and you had two people who were involved in that offense and they had differing stories, how are you going to determine the truth? And there were various means to do it, but there was a science of torture that developed, which was used incrementally in allegedly very controlled ways to elicit the truth from the body of someone. And there was the idea that you could do that. Well, that was an idea that retained considerable support, both politically, culturally, legally, until really about the 16th, 17th century. And then there were changes in attitudes about the way in which truth could be discovered, but there was also greater and greater concern about the state abusing that privilege. And with the Protestant Reformation, then there was all of this denunciations of the Catholic Counter-Reformation and the Inquisition using torture against alleged Jews or alleged Protestants. And so torture increasingly became associated with a violation of someone's fundamental human rights, which were an idea being articulated at that moment in time. So by the time that Europeans were beginning to settle the North American continent, the idea was that torture was something that shouldn't happen often. It should only happen in extraordinary circumstances, usually, and that in, shall we say, more progressive circles, it was increasingly associated with tyranny and despotism.
But we get to use it now and then, and we have been using it even before we were a nation. Americans on this continent were certainly employing torture when they felt it was necessary.
And that's where the binary, if you will, the contrast between civilization on the one hand and barbarism is so crucial to the to sustaining the idea that torture in certain circumstances can be used. What happens if you're in, we'll say, a state of war with a society who you believe is not civilized like you are and doesn't follow the rules of warfare that you follow? Well, then all, you know, any possible military necessity is justified. So Americans, or before Americans, European colonists could distinguish between their violence against Native Americans, who were primitive, barbaric, and could treat them in ways that they wouldn't, that is, that Europeans would never treat themselves because we're civilized. So that's a kind of an idea that crops up periodically, and it justifies, for example, in the case of after the Spanish-American War, when the United States occupied the Philippines and we were suppressing an insurrection in the Philippines, there was justifications with that the Filipinos are barbaric people. They only understand violence, so we must use drastic measures we would otherwise never condone.
Yeah, and talk about the way that this works. Number one, it's a justification. In other words, we're not in a fair fight anymore, so we got it if we're going to win, and this is an important struggle. But the other is who we use this against, the idea that these civilized people might very well, civilized people on whom we would never use torture, probably look a lot more like us than the uncivilized people on whom we have to use this.
You're certainly right. The victims, so to speak, of torture have traditionally been people who are distinguished either by ethnicity or by race or sometimes religion, which is wrapped up in that as well. Although it's important to acknowledge that an important tradition, so to speak, of American torture has been violence by police against alleged suspects being interrogated, allegedly interrogated. And sometimes the victims of police abuse were no different than the police themselves. They were certainly immigrants and African Americans were disproportionately likely to be victims, but there are plenty of middle class whites who were subjected to the so-called third degree by the police. So there, it's also important to see the ways in which power can allow one group to consign the group that they subject to torture to a category that places them subject to torture.
Yeah, that categorization, if it takes hold in the public imagination, is what gives it cover, right? So if you're an accused criminal, an accused rapist, right, or an accused murderer, murder is the word that jumps out at you, and so whatever you do to them is fine because I'm not a murderer, so you wouldn't do that to me. And, of course, the other side, and as you say, the racial distinction, or terrorist, which is everybody who's not me, you know, because I would never do that, and so whatever you have to do to a terrorist is fair game.
Yeah, I think you said that well. In essence, what it takes, you obviously have to have the power and the circumstances to be in a position when you can torture someone, and virtually everyone I'm interested in talking about, or not interested in talking about, but I think it's important to talk about, are alleged agents of the state. They claim to be acting on behalf of the state. But the important step that they must take is that they lose the capacity to somehow empathize with the person they're going to torture. And whatever basis they arrive at that loss of empathy is the one that then becomes a justification.
And we were talking now about state use of terror, mostly in war, but also, as you say, in terms of policing. And lynching, you point out, is another example of this kind of thing.
Yes, because the line between lynching and some of the police violence of the late 19th, early 20th century is often thin, a very thin line, especially in the American South, although not exclusively. And by a thin line, what I mean is most of the victims of lynch mobs in the late 19th and early 20th century were seized from law officers. So they were in the hands of public authorities. And when I say they were seized, well, sometimes they were virtually handed over by the police or law officers. Other times they were law officers were actively participating. But the point is that agents of the state had a certain level of complicity in the actual act. But even if they weren't complicit in the act, they were complicit in virtually never punishing anyone. And where they overlap is the idea of punishing someone who has left the bounds of modern civilization. They're beyond the pale, so to speak. And what lynch mobs did was they, of course, carried it further than the police usually did. They didn't usually kill suspects.
The police didn't.
The police didn't, yes, I'm sorry. But the mob acted out, if you will. The torture that the mob acted out was sometimes more extremes than the police acted out. But it's an extension of the idea that you need to wreak havoc on the body of these people because they are so far beyond the pale.
Yeah, and talk about that. In this double consciousness, I'm curious to know how, to what extent Americans, when they feel torture is justified, either define it out of existence, it's not torture, or justify it and say that for some other reason we have to use it now.
Absolutely. So there, one, you're right, justify it out of, you come up with alternative phrases. The one that's probably most familiar to us is enhanced interrogation. The George W. Bush administration was emphatic to the present day of insisting that waterboarding, et cetera, was not torture. It was enhanced interrogation. Another example of that would be, say, the New York Times described enhanced interrogation techniques using the language of the Bush administration. But when they described those same techniques being used by other societies, they described them as torture. So that's a very important way of separating the two. The other is to say that, well, we're really in a situation that's so extraordinary. The circumstances are so threatening. The challenges to our democracy are so great that we must fight using whatever tools are available. And in these circumstances, we have to use these tools. And so there's always the argument that it's pragmatically necessary because we generate information that otherwise we wouldn't have, or that we so intimidate the criminal elements that they desist in doing whatever it is that we don't want them to do. So there is one, an act of denial, and the other act is an act of legitimation.
Let's talk about a specific example, and I want to talk about, you mentioned the Philippines earlier, which did come to the public attention, and it was a matter for debate around the turn of the 20th century. And fascinating, a man named Herbert Welsh, who sort of more or less took it upon himself, a Native American rights activist, but also took on the question of the Philippines and gained at least some traction.
He did. He was well-positioned, and he was a very, very wealthy, we would call him now a social activist, but a very, very wealthy, well-placed Philadelphia social activist who had a number of causes he was interested in. But he was really deeply committed to an idea of 19th century American democracy and progress, which was somehow the nation was going to actually fulfill the promise spelled out in the Declaration of Independence. And so when the United States became an imperialist nation as a result of the Spanish-American War, and we literally had possessions from the Caribbean all the way to virtually to the shores of China, he was deeply alarmed because he then started doing, if you will, a thought experiment. And he said, well, if we're going to have military possessions all over the world, we're going to have a large standing army. And if we're going to have a large standing army for the first time in our history, it's going to have implications for our democracy. It's also going to have implications for the way in which we spread democracy around the world. Instead of an ideal, it's going to be a mode of government that we are going to impose on these people. And in the meantime, he was deeply suspicious about whether or not we would actually share democracy with the people of the Philippines, for example.
I'm talking with Fitzhugh Brundage, the author of Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition. Our conversation is happening right here on The State of Things.
So in the case of the Philippines, he was worried that we were going to have to impose democracy, as he said, at the point of a bayonet. And in fact, the Filipino insurrectionists, they wanted a kind of nationalist democracy of sorts, but they wanted it without American occupation, of course. And so he anticipated that what was going to happen is as resistance to the United States mounted, the United States would be caught in a guerrilla warfare, in a guerrilla war. And as we were waging that war, we would increasingly adopt techniques that would make a sham of our claims of bringing democracy to the Philippines. And he was very, very prescient. I mean, he nailed what happened with great accuracy.
Not only there, but in the decades to follow. Mm-hmm. And right up to today, so there's an opinion piece in today's New York Times written by James Baker, former Secretary of State under the George H.W. Bush, talking about the Khashoggi assassination or the murder of that journalist and dissident. And he's warning the United States not to go too far in its sanctions against Saudi Arabia. This is just a section of what he writes. Opposition to the killing of dissidents and support for a free and robust press are fundamental American principles. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia has been an important strategic partner of the United States, and it goes on to say, let them go.
So that's there's the process of calibrating, if you will, how we justify or if not justify, at least explain away torture. In this case, it's aberrant, appalling behavior by the Saudis follows a very kind of there's a kind of argument that is usually made. One is that we've sort of seen the attempt by the Saudis and the Trump administration to make this, well, bad things happen and things got out of hand. Then the next line of argument is, well, these were a few bad apples. You know, these are people who they went too far. It's terrible. And then they may be, that is, whoever's justifying it, may be forced into somehow explaining away what happened. And then they'll say, well, we were in extreme circumstances, and we have to consider the nation's interest. And so security is ultimately the ultimate defense.
Right.
You can always say, well, the security justified it.
But I think you in the academic world call this an overdetermined argument. On the one hand, it was an accident and shouldn't have happened. But if we did intend it, then we intended it because it was the only option we had.
And it's and in all fairness, it's important. There may, for all I know, there may be circumstances where all of those denials actually apply. But what is important, I think, about understanding these arguments about torture is we can see how, in a sense, they're innate to American democracy and what we value.
Let me stop you, because I've only got 30 seconds for this.
Right.
Does it say anything about us that we feel the need at least to lie or at least
exactly
to justify? So it does say something about our aspiration, which is not what we had had centuries
right
ago. And that's a good thing.
And those aspirations are a tool that Welsh used and that John McCain used. And it's important to recognize that those tools in and of themselves aren't going to stop the torture. But they may limit it or they may cause us to reflect on it and say, well, we're not going to do it again, even though when the circumstances arise, we might.
Fitzhugh Brundage is William Umstead Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book is called Civilizing Torture, an American Tradition. Fitz, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, she's been fighting for social justice. Now she wants a seat on the state Supreme Court. Meet Anita Earls next. Stay tuned.